To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info. The number is 430-9722. That's 430-WSCA. And now we bring you some people's history, our history, to look back on, remember, and be inspired by. On November 27th in 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. announced the Poor People's Campaign from the Stanford.edu group. In November 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. and the staff of the Southern Christian Leadership Coalition met to discuss the direction of the movement following the victories of the civil rights legislation, the emergence of black power, and urban riots the previous summer. SCLC decided to launch the Poor People's Campaign, a movement to broadly address economic inequalities with nonviolent direct action. The campaign was not launched until after King's 1968 assassination, however, and the absence of King's leadership was believed to have compromised the campaign's effectiveness. The idea for the Poor People's Campaign grew out of what King termed the second phase of the civil rights struggle. After the first phase had exposed the problems of segregation through nonviolence, King hoped to address what he called the limitations to our achievements with a second phase. In its ideology and style, the Poor People's Campaign demonstrated a merging of first phase tactics into second phase goals. Through nonviolent direct action, King and SCLC hoped to focus the nation on economic inequality and poverty. The campaign also differed from previous SCLC campaigns, as it aimed to address the struggles of a cross-section of minority groups. It must not be just black people, argued King. It must be all poor people. We must include American Indians, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, and even poor whites. SCLC planned the Poor People's Campaign to be the most massive, widespread campaign of civil disobedience yet undertaken by a movement. They aimed to bring 1,500 protesters to Washington, D.C. to lobby Congress and other governmental agencies for an economic bill of rights. Specifically, the campaign requested a $30 billion anti-poverty package that would include a commitment to full employment, a guaranteed annual income measure, and increased construction of low-income housing. Protest activities in Washington were to be supported by simultaneous demonstrations throughout the country. Despite division within SCLC over the campaign's feasibility, King embraced the campaign and traveled across the country speaking on poverty and went to people-to-people tours to recruit participants. On April 4, 1968, King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. The King family and SCLC leadership decided to go on with a campaign to honor King. On May 12, 1968, the first wave of demonstrators arrived in Washington, D.C. 1 week later, Resurrection City was built on the Washington Mall, a settlement of tents and shacks to house the protesters. Demonstrators were sent out to various federal agencies to protest and spread the message of the campaign. Although Ralph Abernathy had taken over as SCLC president following King's death, the campaign's leadership lacked the momentum that King might have provided. The combined setbacks of bad press, Robert Kennedy's assassination, and an overwhelming number of protesters, 7,000 at its peak, further limited the campaign's effectiveness. Failing to force a response from legislators, the Poor People's Campaign closed camp on June 19, 1968. Some more recent history was made on November 30th in 1999, when the Seattle WTO meetings were shut down by activists. Here is some reflection on that event by Jeremy Atkin, who is from the Rural Organizing Project of Oregon and was there for the WTO meeting protests. Written on December 5th, 1999. Michael Moore, theirs, not ours, said that the people who were planning to protest the WTO were a bunch of grumpy, geriatric communists. That would be me. The truth, of course, was far from that. While activists of every age were present on the mean streets of Seattle, this was an action of, by, and for the young. It was a baptism by pepper spray for a new generation of activists, and capitalism will rue the day it decided to throw a party in the Emerald City. Things will never be the same, and let me tell you why. The two chants that could be heard again and again from the heady, creative, and beautiful actions of the civilly disobedient, to a massive labor march, to the spontaneous leaderless demonstrations in Portland were, "Ain't no power like the power of the people, and the power of the people don't stop." Whose streets? Our streets. Whose streets? Our streets. Well, they're not our streets yet, except in fits and starts, but for one glorious day in Seattle, it was true. My favorite example of the Our Streets phenomenon was Monday night, after the steelworkers and the Jubilee 2000 people marched together and surrounded the Access dinner. As we were leaving, bands of marauding teenagers would pull up to an intersection, pile out of the van, pump up the volume, and occupy the intersection with an incredibly sweet energy by dancing and singing that simple lyric, "Our streets, our streets, our streets." Emma Goldman will love their revolution. So will I. Because the streets should belong to the dancing youth, and the workers coming home from an honest day's labor for an honest day's pay, and the lovers lingering in the sidewalk cafes, and the old women walking their dogs, and not the yuppies and the yuppie wannabes grazing in the meadows of transnational capital with a consumerist face. As for the power of the people, there's just one little catch. For the power of the people to don't stop, it has to start. People have to claim their power and exercise it. And in order to do that, they'll have to wake up from the sleep of their virtual lives, overcome their lethargy fueled by television, and decide what kind of world they want beyond the confines of their own narrow lives. What kind of world they want for their grandchildren's grandchildren. And this is where we come in. I once saw an awful sign on twin pylons as I left a mission on the Navajo reservation. The words painted on the first pylon said, "Tradition is the enemy of progress." On the second, "For without a vision, the people perish." Well, the first slogan is open to a number of interpretations, depending on how you feel about progress and who gets to define it, but the second slogan is unassailably true. Without a vision, the people perish, and as a nation, we have been perishing for a very long time. Our job is to create and embody that vision for people, the joy of our convictions, the practice of our beliefs. And behind the screen of tear gas and pepper spray, that is exactly what happened in Seattle. We were caught barehanded in the act of joyful solidarity with each other and the planet. Across race, class, age, and gender lines, we stood together. This was our crime, and they had no choice but to lock some of us up. Who can blame them? This is subversive stuff. Okay, I said I'd tell you why things would never be the same, why capital would rue the day it sent its caterers into our convention center to feed the agents of the ruling class and not the people. But for that one glorious day, they were our streets, and the power of the people didn't stop until the WTO was shut down, reduced to futility, exposed and set home with its collective tail between its legs. The power of the people came up against a combination of arrogance and poor judgment on the part of the WTO and the city fathers, and the people won a complete and stunning victory. So, there is a new generation of activists, mixed with several generations of older activists who have tasted victory, who have seen the proof of the power we always claim to have, but don't often see succeeding on such a gigantic scale. All those little victories, of course, prepared the way for the larger victory. But what really made this victory possible was something a little less glamorous than the storming of the Bastille. It was planning. This victory did not fall from the sky. It was built on a combination of conviction, dedication, courage, hard work, and a framework for organizing the Festival of Resistance, including the civil disobedience. Things will never be the same because activists of every stripe hit the streets together and discovered that that cliched and overused word, solidarity, has been an underused practice. We discovered the reality of what we suspected and even said along the way, that we face a common enemy. Some call it corporate dominance. I call it capital. Scratch an impression and you'll find capital, with its winners and losers mentality and its divide and conquer tactics. Some of us, at least, really got it, that we have been pitted against each other in a way that makes no sense. It is, after all, quite possible to create a world that protects labor and the environment. It's like convincing us that one of our children must die and asking us to choose, do you want a planet or a job? This is not a choice. On the other hand, do you want labor, health, and environmental standards? Or a DVD player and a couple sets of Pokemon cards? Is. What happened in the streets of Seattle was wonderful, brilliant, exhilarating, and scary. The police state, even when you have it off balance, is a scary thing. We have our power, and they have theirs. Ours builds a better world, creates a vision of possibility. Theirs is simply the power to brutalize and incarcerate, a very real power. Bill Resnick pointed out that if this demonstration was in New York and the protesters were people of color, there would have been real bullets in the guns and the level of police violence would have been much worse. It's much harder to beat those white kids senseless on national TV. So, as great as our victory was, it is only a first step, or maybe a third step, in a journey of 1,000 miles. But it is a step, and once we're on the journey, there's nowhere left to go but forward. Things will never be the same, because we know that we can win. Things will never be the same, because we will never be the same. From Jerry Atkin on December 5th, 1999, reflecting on the Battle of Seattle.
It's the same the whole world over. Township, doing our best as best we can. Tomorrow 10,000 miles away. Tonight we dance. Tomorrow 10,000 miles away. Tonight we dance. clever lover. We got a planet full of strangers busy dancing with each other. Dancing in the darkness, dancing in the jet house rock. Dancing in the rainforest, dancing in the street protest.
Rob Johnson with Tonight We Dance. And now, from Bridgeport, Connecticut, we bring you Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeremy Brecker, co-editor of the book In the Name of Democracy, American War Crimes in Iraq and Beyond, who discusses investigations into U.S. war crimes and the responsibility of citizens to challenge their government's violation of international law. Mavis Anderson of the Latin America Working Group, who talks about the fate of a recent amendment introduced in the Senate to stop enforcement of the U.S. travel ban against Cuba. And California State Representative Fran Pavley, who describes the battle now being waged over landmark automobile fuel efficiency standards in her state. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The BBC reports acting Iraqi Human Rights Minister Narmeen Uthman is investigating the use of white phosphorus by U.S. troops in the siege of Fallujah in November 2004. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Barry Venable recently confirmed the use of white phosphorus as an incendiary weapon against enemy combatants and for lighting up the night sky. Earlier, the U.S. State Department claimed the weapon was only used in Fallujah for illumination. White phosphorus is a highly flammable agent and ignites on contact with oxygen. When it hits a human being, it will burn flesh. Its use against civilians is prohibited by Protocol 3 of the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, a treaty the U.S. government has not signed. The controversy over the use of white phosphorus in Fallujah broke with the recent Italian television documentary, Fallujah: The Hidden Massacre, which quotes a human rights activist talking about how a rain of fire fell over the city. During the two-week siege of Fallujah, 50 American troops, an estimated 800 civilians, and 1,200 insurgents were killed. In the March 2005 edition of Field Artillery, officers from the 2nd Infantry's support team boasted about their use of white phosphorus during combat operations. During one firefight, they claimed, quote, "We fired shake-and-bake missions at the insurgents, using white phosphorus to flush them out and high explosives to take them out," unquote. The combined crises of the Asian tsunami, Hurricane Katrina, and the massive earthquake in Pakistan-controlled Kashmir are forcing humanitarian aid agencies to scramble to raise millions of dollars for relief. In recent months, critics find some of the aid appeals feature what they are saying are inappropriate images of naked victims that rely on outdated stereotypes. Referring to this practice as development pornography, Nikki Vandergog, a freelance writer and editor, told Reuters that many aid agencies have lowered their standards over the last 10 years, adding, "You have to think, would I like my picture or my child's picture taken like this?" Critics point to images of starving women and children that circulated in the Western media during the food crisis in Niger. Peter Davis of Oxfam said pictures from Africa were selected using different standards from those that would apply elsewhere. He added, using pictures of bare-breasted women in a society where the only other place we see that is salacious tabloids is not acceptable. Major European aid agencies are planning to release new fundraising guidelines in November 2006 to promote best practices without harming the dignity of victims. 20 million acres of public land could be sold if a proposed change in federal mining law is adopted. The provision, sponsored by House Republicans, would overturn a congressional ban on allowing mining corporations or individuals to buy public land at discounted prices if the land contains mineral deposits. As Dave Albersworth, public lands director for the Wilderness Society, told the Associated Press, it could literally lead to the privatization of millions of acres of public land, including national parks and forests. A repeal of the ban on government land sales could lead to a loss of an additional 14 million acres of land to mining. All it would take to file a claim is the potential of a profitable mining deposit. California Senator Dianne Feinstein has called on House Republicans to table the mining provision. She claims it would allow small groups to carve out numerous private enclaves within our public lands. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Bush administration justified a whole range of foreign and domestic policies that either skirted or directly violated U.S. constitutional law or international treaties such as the Geneva Conventions. From President Bush's defiance of the United Nations in launching his war against Iraq to official policies that led to the torture and mistreatment of detainees, America's image as a defender of human rights has been severely tarnished. Photos of Iraqi detainees being tortured at Abu Ghraib prison, alongside accounts of mistreatment at U.S.-run detention centers in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have provoked lawsuits and investigations. While Washington's covert rendition of prisoners to third nations for the purpose of torture and recent press reports alleging U.S. secret prisons in Eastern Europe have only inflamed hatred and fear of the U.S. government. A recent Italian television documentary charging that the U.S. military used napalm and white phosphorus weapons in the 2004 siege of Fallujah are just the latest set of disturbing accusations undermining America's standing in the world community. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jeremy Brecker, co-editor of the book In the Name of Democracy, American War Crimes in Iraq and Beyond. Brecker, a historian, discusses investigations into U.S. war crimes and the responsibility of ordinary citizens to challenge their government's violation of international law.
The book is about a very disturbing topic, which is the evidence for the United States is involved in committing war crimes in Iraq, and then trying to deal with what that means, how we address that and come to terms with it, both as a country and as individuals, what our responsibilities are, what we can do about it. And range of war crimes are really the range that has been many different kinds of crimes that have been identified at the Nuremberg tribunals after World War II and by the Geneva Conventions and the United Nations Charter and many international agreements that our country is part of. And actually also many of them are crimes under United States law, like the War Crimes Act and the Anti-Torture Act. These are crimes like torture, like making an aggressive war. The Iraq War itself, as Kofi Annan said very explicitly, was illegal. It was a violation of the UN Charter. And daily we read news about families being wiped out, There's recently been a major Italian documentary exposing the use of an illegal weapon, white phosphorus, against civilians. The government says it was, yes, it did use white phosphorus, but just for flares and illumination. But the Italian documentary has pictures of the flesh melting on these families and kids. So the reality that we're facing and confronting here is of the same kinds of things that are charged against Milosevic and charged against Saddam Hussein, not necessarily on the same scale, but our country has been led into those kinds of actions. And the administration has very much blamed, where it's admitted some degree of prisoner abuse and other abuses, it's blamed it on the young men and women, people who have gone and made great sacrifices personally, and then they are being blamed for things like Abu Ghraib by the very people who have set the policies, the very top officials who have set the policies that have led things like Abu Ghraib to happen.
Jeremy, talk a little bit, if you would, on this seemingly shocking tact of the Bush administration. Vice President Cheney has gone to Congress and basically wants a legal exception made to allow mistreatment of detainees abroad by U.S. intelligence officers. It seems like they are so arrogant and brazen to do what really virtually no other country, no matter how despotic, has ever done before.
From the time of the beginning of U.S. going into Afghanistan, the top officials in the Bush administration have been obsessed with torture, but have also been obsessed with the need to protect themselves against legal charges for conducting torture. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, then White House attorney, the president's attorney, wrote a memo saying what we have to do is just declare that the Geneva Agreement Accords, which are the most fundamental international law governing treatment of civilians, treatment of prisoners, of war, basically what you can and cannot do. We just have to say that it doesn't apply. We just have to, as he said, opt out. And the reason that Gonzalez gave was because the American War Crimes Act might be used by a special prosecutor in the future to prosecute American officials for war crimes. This whole apparatus with Cheney and torture is in large part because there is vast evidence that they are already in violation of the law. There is certainly enough evidence to bring indictments against top United States officials for torture and other war crimes. And there is lots of evidence indicating that the policies that allowed this were encouraged that go to the highest levels of the Bush administration. And I think they have every reason to be afraid.
Jeremy, you discuss in the book some of the moral questions about citizens and their responsibilities in time of war, particularly when their nation breaks international law or commits human rights abuses. If you were to put it in a nutshell, what's the average citizen's responsibility in a time like we're living through now in the U.S.?
Well, you know, when the Nazi concentration camps were discovered and the Nazi war crimes were exposed, there was a phrase that was used, where were the good Germans? Where were the people you would have expected to stand up to this? And I think that's a question we've all learned to ask ourselves, or certainly should have learned to ask ourselves. This is a problem not just for Germans. It's not a problem just for Serbs. It's not a problem just for people of any one or another country. People in many countries have been placed in the moral situation of having their government engaged in war crimes. The first thing is that top government officials are directly accountable. This is the principle that was established in Nuremberg and has continued to be a central practice of international law, as it is, of course, of national law. If crimes are committed by people by people at the bottom, the people at the top who instructed them to do so or allowed them to do so are responsible. However, it goes beyond that because really, if we know about what's going on or should know about it or could know about it, unless we tried not to, then we have an affirmative obligation to take measures to bring those crimes to a halt. And again, this is a broad principle of national law and of international law. It's formulated in Nuremberg. It's not just government officials who are responsible. If we're in a position to do anything about it, and we don't, then we are not meeting our responsibilities, and we are essentially complicit with criminal acts. And what affirmative measures we're in a position to take obviously differs for different people.
That was Jeremy Brecker, co-editor of the book In the Name of Democracy, American War Crimes in Iraq and Beyond, published by Metropolitan Books. In an October 20th Senate debate on the Treasury Department budget, Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat from North Dakota, reintroduced his amendment to cut funding for enforcement of the travel ban against Cuba. However, before members of the state engaged in full debate on the issue, Senator John Ensign, a Republican from Nevada, succeeded in introducing a second-degree amendment to Senator Dorgan's proposal. Senator Ensign's amendment was related to the issue of parental consent for abortions. Given the controversial nature of the abortion issue, Senator Dorgan ultimately withdrew his proposal and criticized Ensign's maneuver as arbitrary and anti-democratic. Both U.S. citizens and members of Congress are increasingly supportive of free and open travel to Cuba. However, the Bush administration recently tightened travel restrictions by limiting trips by Cuban Americans to visit their families in Cuba to once every 3 years and only with special permission. Your reporter Denise Manzari spoke with Mavis Anderson, senior associate with the Latin America Working Group, who talks about the fate of the Dorgan Amendment and what her group will be doing to combat the ongoing travel ban by the United States against Cuba.
Senator Ensign's amendment had to do with abortion, nothing to do with Cuba, nothing to do with travel. Its sole purpose was to put the senators from both sides of the aisle in muddy waters and force the withdrawal of the amendment. His action was procedurally legal, but really unbelievable, as Senator Dorgan said. And had it been challenged, it probably could have fallen to a point of order, since it was not germane. But the fact that it was on abortion was what was so confusing, because senators who support abortion and don't support travel to Cuba were put in a strange position, and senators who support travel to Cuba but would not have voted for a freestanding amendment on abortion were put in a bad position. So it was an untenable combination. So Senator Ensign, who doesn't have a bone to pick in this issue, has been the one who's been identified as the point person to make sure that this kind of amendment does not happen. And actually, I know that one of his constituents, one of Senator Ensign's constituents, called him to complain and asked what in the world he was doing. And his staff person very clearly said to this constituent, this amendment wasn't about abortion. This amendment was simply to get the Cuba travel amendment off the floor. And it worked. And Senator Dorgan was very gracious. He did say in his withdrawal speech that he felt it was unbelievable, and he said elementary and high school students should all be watching today to see just how politics in this country really work.
As time goes on, actually, more and more U.S. citizens and Congress members as well seem to support free and open travel to Cuba, and yet, you know, this maneuver certainly undermined Senator Dorgan's attempt at stopping the travel ban.
The Congress, in a bipartisan way, in fact, often with Republican leadership, has been working for 5 years to end or ease the ban on travel to Cuba. Polls show that the American people favor that by some 70%. Polls show that the Cuban-American community in South Florida, in their majority, favor easing the travel ban, especially the ban on family travel. And votes in both the House and Senate have in the past been bipartisan and strong in favor of it. And what happens? Other procedural measures and backdoor maneuvers are taken that remove language that passes in both the House and the Senate and comes to conference and the Republican leadership discards it. That's not democracy. That does not respect the will either of the Congress or of the American people. And it has to end.
In Dorgan's speech, he also said that he feels that this was just a small setback in efforts to end the travel ban. What is your opinion?
I think that there will continue to be efforts. Certainly, Congress will continue in this effort, and the non-governmental organizations who work with Congress, like the Latin America Working Group, will continue in this effort. But under this administration, we keep butting our heads up against a stone wall. And in this and other issues, I think we all have seen that it's a pretty obstinate and arrogant administration that does not bow to opinions other than their own. So it was a setback, yes. It's not the end of the game, but I'm not sure I'd call it minor.
What about Latin America Working Group? What will you be doing regarding this issue?
Well, we will continue to work legislatively in providing information and education to the members of Congress. We will continue to work with constituents in helping them to make their voices heard. We will continue to work with Cuban Americans who want to be able to visit their families. We will work with educators who want to be able to do study abroad trips to Cuba. We will work with cultural groups who are very eager for cultural and artistic exchange with Cuba. So what we're probably doing is taking it in smaller bites, but all of those are important pieces. I think that the key here is that from a government, the United States government, who consistently criticizes Cuba for being non-democratic and heavy-handed, for us then to resort to these kinds of undemocratic and behind-closed-doors kinds of methods to thwart the will of the American people, I think is just a travesty.
That was Mavis Anderson, Senior Associate with the Latin America Working Group. For more information, contact the group by calling area code 202-546-7010 or visit their website at www.lawg.org. Many motorists confronting the recent spike in gasoline prices are sitting up and paying attention to fuel efficiency, some for the first time. But the federal government is still dragging its feet regarding fuel economy standards, and years ago the initiative passed to the states. California passed a landmark global warming bill in 2002 that also increases fuel efficiency standards. It's called the Pavley Law after its main sponsor, Fran Pavley. Pavley was elected to the California State Assembly in 2000, where she is an outspoken defender of the environment. Her bill requires automobile manufacturers to reduce tailpipe emissions by 30% by the year 2016, beginning with the 2009 model year. Similar legislation has been passed in half a dozen other states, mostly in the Northeast. Although the bill was enacted into law, signed by the former governor, and supported by the current governor, it is now tied up in litigation brought by an alliance of automotive interests. The outcome is uncertain. California, with its large share of the auto market, has enormous influence on the development of auto technology nationally and internationally. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pavley during a Clean Vehicles and Global Warming conference in Hartford, Connecticut on October 24th. She describes the broad coalition organized to get her legislation passed and the forces aligned against it in a state with 36 million residents and 25 million cars.
It was a broad-based coalition. It started out with primarily just environmental groups, Sierra Club, Natural Resources Defense Council, etc. And it got broadened to include health organizations who understood the impact and relationship between climate change and health issues such as asthma. And then amazing other groups came on board. I particularly enjoyed working with the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, the venture capitalists from the heart of California's economy. And they saw that California taking the lead in new technologies would be in their best economic interest. They brought a whole new dynamic and perspective to the halls of the Capitol in supporting this bill. So it wasn't just an environmental bill. It was in California's best interest economically to move forward. Other groups involved, besides Hollywood celebrities and politicians, local cities and counties passing resolutions in support of California moving forward, but also a group of religious leaders, 160 religious leaders from Christian, Muslim, and Jewish faiths, Interfaith Council, brought a whole different perspective to this, talking about morally that California, United States should be protecting the earth. And they actually met individually with different legislators, depending upon their faith, to discuss this with them, took out full-page ads. But that brought a whole new dynamic as well to the discussion on climate change and why we should move forward.
So the bill was passed in 2002, signed by the governor, the former governor, Gray Davis, and the regulations adopted unanimously by the California Air Resources Board in 2004, but it's still being opposed, and there's litigation going on right now trying to stop it, I guess. Can you talk about what's happening right now?
After the regulations were adopted unanimously, under the leadership of a new governor. So we've had both Democratic and Republican governors supporting these regulations. In December of 2004, the big three automobile manufacturers, Ford, Daimler, Chrysler, and General Motors, filed suit. International automobile companies have also joined the litigation to overturn California's clean car regulations. The final decision regarding legally whether we can move forward has yet to be determined. So in the meanwhile, the clock is ticking. I'm hoping that the manufacturing companies will go ahead in developing technologies and reassembling their assembly lines in order to meet the clean car regulations. So the courts should hear the case within the next year. The automobile manufacturers have hired top legal counsel. The Attorney General's Office, as well as Sierra Club, Environmental Defense, and Natural Resources Defense Council, will join forces in hopefully making sure that the legislation stay in effect and that all states in the United States have the option of adopting California's clean car regulations.
Say a little more about the international automakers' opposition. It includes car makers who are making clean cars. It includes Toyota, you said, and also Honda?
The International Alliance, which includes all international car companies, have also joined suit with America's big three companies, much to my disappointment, and includes companies that tout their environmentally friendly cars. I happen to drive a Toyota Prius. It's a hybrid. And Toyota's part of the litigation, as well as Honda. And automobile companies that their home is in the EU. And interestingly enough, they're working within their own countries to meet the Kyoto Protocol targets, yet denying California and ultimately the United States from doing our fair share.
You mentioned the participation at some point of the environmental justice community coming on board and supporting it, but now you also mentioned that they have some disagreements with some of the possible solutions, including cap and trade policy. So what about that, and how do you think environmentalists and other people who aren't so much part of the environmental justice movement per se can come to an agreement on what to do?
That's going to be our biggest discussion as we're moving forward not only in the mobile sector but also stationary sources, is creating market incentives to make sure that the private sector works cooperatively. They're very interested in cap and trade. Big businesses who do business nationally and internationally know that the rest of the world is engaged in cap and trade. We're going to have a lot of discussion with the environmental justice communities that capping emissions, they support, that's a good thing, but what they don't want is all of a sudden new plants being built in their communities so they're disproportionately affected.
That was California Assemblywoman Fran Pavley. For more information on fuel efficiency legislation, contact the Natural Resources Defense Council at area code 212-727-2700 or visit their website at www.nrdc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. We are particularly looking for interviewers, so let us know by writing to nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com if you want to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you now with this quote by Emma Goldman. If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.